Greetings and salutations, everyone. This is AT2GS. My name is Roy, and I'm the net control operator for this, the Limewatch Technical Net. Limewatch Technical Net has been going strong for almost 43 years. And every Sunday night at 8 p.m., we get together on W2BL and on Selbit, Wix, and try to inform, educate each other, learn from each other, entertain and amuse each other. So I am very thankful for all the people who have cut out their Sunday nights on their calendar and sit in front of their radio and listen and hopefully participate in the experience. So let me drop for a second and I will give you the usual link. Okay. If you need to reach me, you can reach me on the radio, but if you can't get me on the radio, then email is a good substitute. This would be either for what we used to call mailbag questions. Those are questions that you would regularly ask of the technical net, but if you weren't able to get on the air on a Sunday night, then you put it in email form and you send it to, in the old days, you would send it to Mel, K2KY, or you would send it to John, KC2WGB, and he would read it to Big K2RIW, and Dick would answer. So you just send me the email, and we will review it. And if it's good material, we'll discuss it. Also, if you have a topic for discussion, sometimes people hear something in the news, and they're very familiar with the subject, and they would like to do a little presentation. Sometimes it's someone who wants to be part of a discussion. And sometimes it's people who just want to learn about a topic but don't know that much, and so they just want to listen to a bunch of other people who know better. So that's the reason. Also, if you have a puzzle to submit, I'm always looking for technical puzzles. Usually technical puzzles that can't be answered by just Googling them is better. I believe it's the journey that counts more than the destination. So, you know, if someone just kind of gives the answer in the first 10 seconds, it kind of ruins it all. So that's another one. And the last but not least is if you have a NASA or space-related story that you come across and you want to get Paul WS2N's view on the subject, you can either email him directly at spacenetreport@gmail.com or you can send it to me and I'll send it to him. So my email address for this purpose is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. Let me drop for a sec.
Roy, WHCDO.
Yes, Andy.
Check your antenna or power. You're quite noisy into the repeater tonight.
Okay, how is it now?
I talk a little bit longer. Sounded slightly stronger, but you're usually a lot stronger than you are now.
Did you hear my signal at all?
Yeah, I hear you, but there is considerable noise in the background.
Well, I don't know what to tell you. I don't know what has changed. But not a good amount of power. So, I don't know.
Bobby.
Signal is weak.
Roy, WTBC, I hear it too.
Okay, again, don't know. Let me just tighten a couple of connections, I'll be right back.
WS2N. Boy, if you're listening, you... Most weeks you start off a little low, but as the night progresses, you get louder, just for some reason. And by the way, good evening, Andy. WS to us.
Okay, Paul. Yeah, it's kind of strange why that would happen.
Yeah, I don't know, but I you know, every week I notice that. Comes out a little on the low side, you know. I mean, yeah, tonight's a little bit lower than normal. I don't think it's this connection.
Hello again. I couldn't find anything particularly loose.
You're getting in. I mean, you know, we hear you. I just wanted to mention that, you know, just in case there was an issue that you didn't know about. Okay.
Okay, well, I don't know about, well, you told me about it, but I don't know why it is. I've revved it up as high as the ICOM 7100 can do. I can throw in my linear amplifier. I would prefer not to because I probably burnt out a previous antenna doing that. So, you know, unless I really have to, I'd rather not.
No, you don't have to. I mean, I hear what you're saying. Okay, I just brought that up, that's all.
Okay, very good. Anyway, getting back, I'm AC2GS. Mentioned mailbag at AC2GS. Also, we have a link page. Through the week, I call a bunch of interesting YouTubes and articles, and I cut and paste the link on my link page, which is roy.ac2gs.com. At your convenience, it's available 24/7 and stays up for years. So any old time, you can just go over and click to it. There's a couple of interesting articles on the subject, and you might find it interesting. There's an article about the so-called Havana syndrome that we've talked about in the past. Intelligence agencies issued a medium to high, how do they phrase it? Medium to high confidence report that there's no high energy super weapon. That it probably was, unfortunately, hysteria. So that was interesting, and there's a bunch of other things that are interesting as well. Anyway, that's at roy.ac2gs.com. We have a chat room available. You can type into your browser chat.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring you to the chat room. We have audio streaming of the technical net. You type into your browser technet.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring you the audio stream via the internet. I keep that up 24/7. So at any time, if you have internet access but you can't get into the repeater, you can use technet.ac2gs.com to let you listen in to Glen Oak. And as always, I'd like to remind people of my KC2NJI's great archive site called amateurradio.tv. It has over 1 million visitors, and it houses the archives of the Limark technical net that goes as far back as September of 2006. So check it out. There's wisdom there from many hams who have moved away or have become silent chiefs. Let me drop for a second, and I'll be right back. Okay. We will ask the audience for any questions of a technical nature. We prefer to have the first two questions be about amateur radio, since this is an amateur radio technical net. But we will discuss any aspect of science and technology. At 8:30, we have the pleasant surprise that Andy will be back with another episode of Andy's Corner. He's has to go to work early tomorrow morning. So around 8:30 or so, we will call upon him to do his presentation, and we will go back to the questions and topics of the people. And I'm just going to ask if they have any. At 10:15 or thereabouts, Paul WS2N will bring us the SpaceNet report, and I will return at approximately 11 o'clock to tie a bow on it and wish you a good week. So that's the plan. If the repeater holds up and people can continue hearing me through whatever is going on with the transmission. Anyway, once again, I'm AC2GS, and we're open for questions. If you have any questions or topics for discussions or comments for tonight, hopefully the first two ones, I would prefer being amateur radio related. But nevertheless, if you have something, please hit that push to talk, give me your first name, and your call sign.
Bravo, Susan. And Eric Shane for Ham Radio.
Rich and Wesley recognized. Anyone else want to put their name down for tonight?
KC2DAW, 40.
Thank you, KC2DAW. Anyone else want to put their name down for any questions or comments or topics for discussions tonight? Okay, maybe a little bit later on things will liven up. Rich, welcome to this episode of the Limar Technical Net. What is your question or comment for tonight?
First of all, Roy, do you hear me okay? I'm coming through Middle Island.
Yes, I'm hearing you very well.
Okay, there is extra noise on your signal tonight. I could confirm that. Anyway, my question is a simple one. I have a 47K ohm resistor connected between the braid and the center conductor of a one-piece foot of coax. Now, if I attach an A, shouldn't I see that as a one-to-one all frequencies? Go ahead.
Well, I think someone is doubling with you, unfortunately, and I hope no one's doubling with me. Let me drop it for a second and listen. No, okay, I don't know what that was. Theoretically, if you place a non-inductive 47 ohm resistance, it should be relatively frequency independent impedance of 50 ohms. For a one-to-one match. And effectively, that's what dummy loads are. They're non-inductive, approximately 50 ohm resistances. Usually, they're built rather bulky. They can tolerate a lot of heat dissipation, or they're dunked in mineral oil to dissipate the heat, or they're placed in a box with a very strong fan to blow air through it to cool it down. But that's what dummy loads are.
Yeah, well, that's what I thought they were. I know that to be. But this NOVNA is, which I fixed my other problem of last week. That was a connector problem where the numbers were jumping all over the place. But this, the SWR is just going up and down from 1.5 megahertz to 50 megahertz. It's just going from the bottom to the top all the way through all the frequencies. And I don't know what that is about. I would think I would see just a line at 1.0 or close to it to 1 from 3.5 megahertz to 50 megahertz. But I'm seeing the whole screen is covered with SWR traces that go up and down, up and down, up and down.
Okay, I was waiting for the repeater to jump. I don't know what's going on, Rich, but early on when you asked me how your signal was, it was sounded very nice, and then about 10 seconds into it, a lot of noise ended up in the background, and there's a lot of noise. It sounds like someone might be doubling with you. It's very difficult to understand. I think, again, it's a problem that my guess is you're alluding to your nano VNA. And I'll probably tell you the same thing that I told you last week. As long as you have the rig expert, I would try to duplicate it. And my guess would be it wouldn't be duplicatable. So it might have been the connection, erratic connection then last week. It might be the erratic connections now. I don't know. But it's probably not giving you legitimate results. So, you know, why it's not giving you legitimate results, I don't quite know, but it could be anything in the nano VNA blockchain of going from the connectors into its electronics. It should give you a constant result as long as it's not an inductive resistance. If it's an inductive resistance, then it doesn't work like that anymore. It has a frequency-dependent impedance, and as you go up and down the frequencies, it changes. So it's a non-inductive 47-ohm resistance that works correctly, one that's designed by winding a bit of resistive wire is not going to give you the proper result.
How do we How do I get to an inductive resistance? What does that take?
It's the technology of how you're getting the resistance. There are a few different ways of producing electrical resistance. It's a non-conductive material trying to conduct. How much of it exists? The best way to have a non-inductive resistance is to have some material that's not. The worst way is an inductive resistance. Inductive resistance is you take something, I don't know, like nichrome wire, you know, something that has a significant amount of resistance, and then you just coil it around. So it's effectively a length of high resistance wire that is compacted in a resistor by coiling it. Ordinarily, if you're not interested in AC or RF, if it's just DC, it won't be any different because an inductive resistor has the same resistance. It doesn't have a different frequency, so it doesn't differ. If anything involves frequency-related circuits, you can't use an inductor as a resistive component because it complicates matters and changes the impedance. So most resistors are non-inductive. They're not coiled wires. They're carbon film, and there are other ways of doing it. But there's only one thing that's really inductive resistance, and that's wire wrapping on a core in the shape of a resistor.
Okay, well, that's what I thought. I thought it would need some kind of coil to produce the inductance, but I should have checked the rig experts for this. It's a bit of a pain in the butt because it's just the board. But I should have done that. I was thinking it could have something to do with this 1 foot, 1.5 foot piece of coax. Could that be possible?
Assuming your coax is not terribly faulty, probably not. Your coax hopefully should be operating with a nominal impedance of 50 ohms, and so it shouldn't enter into this at all.
Okay, let me put the, like I said, I should have done this before I asked the question. Put the rig experts on it, rig expert board on it, see if I don't get, a one-to-one match at 50 ohms. All right, boy, thanks for your help. WTGC.
You're welcome, and good luck with that, as always, Rich. Yeah, I understand the allure of the nano VNA. It's nice, it's small, it's compact, it's inexpensive. You haven't seemed to get a lot of good luck with it. And earlier this morning, I do a 10-meter net, and someone mentioned the difference between, say, a rig expert and a nano VNA. And I went into a short discourse. Ultimately, it's more than just... It's primarily, for most people, a monetary thing. A nano VNA will set you back usually less than $100. A rig expert, depending upon which model you take and how highly it's spec, can cost you 10 times that amount, which is significant. Although most of us really do not need a vector network analyzer that works at gigahertz, especially if most of our work is in HF. It's a lot less expensive to get something like, I think, a rig expert Zoom 54. I think it costs about $300 to change. But, you know, it's still significantly more than a $90 or $80 nano VNA. They are built much more sturdily. You can take them outdoors. You can drop them repeatedly without worrying that they'll break. They have big buttons that you press and good graphic user interface and computer interface if you want to put it up on the screen. And the company stands behind their equipment. I had it repaired once. A voltage regulator chip went bad, and they replaced it without too much problem. But, you know, money is money. I understand that. Once again, this is AC2GS. Anyone else want to put their name on the list for tonight for any topics of discussion, any questions or comments?
WB2QGZ, just a quick comment about the
nano DNA. Yeah, sure, Bill. Feel free.
Hey, good evening, folks. WB2QGZ. So, I have access to a whole bunch of fancy, you know, lab quality VNAs, as well as a nano VNA and, you know, a handful of other stuff. So, if you, on the bench, I've compared the Rode I use every day to the nano VNA, and, you know, it's within a couple tenths of a dB of the really, really expensive test equipment. Where the other units seem to differentiate themselves from the nano VNA is when you're operating in a higher RF environment, when there's more than just you as a test signal. So, for example, a lot of times we're using these on very, very busy cell sites, and the nano VNA would lose its mind, whereas the other stuff won't. Now, one advantage you have, I think, is the nano VNAs will run via a USB or something with a laptop application. I don't know whether it's that Java JVNA or... I've never actually done it myself. I've seen other folks using it, and that gives you a much bigger screen and a much, much better user interface, controlling that thing remotely from a laptop. So, you know, that's my two cents. WB2QGZ.
Okay, thank you very much. So, yeah, I've used that. It helps if you can't squint and see the little display on a little screen that's mounted on it, it makes life much easier. And, yeah, it's kind of amazing what you could do in Java, but it's all written in Java, and it works surprisingly well. I've been impressed by the nano VNA. I promote its use because a lot of people get sticker shock from, you know, $300, $400, $500 VNA FM analyzers. But you know, another point that I just want to make is that, yeah, if you got the thing sitting on your desk and you got a computer next to it, then it's pretty good. You do have to generally repeatedly calibrate it. It seems to need repeat calibrations a little bit more than most of the other VNAs that I've worked with in the past. But the thing I particularly appreciate about the Rig Expert is its durability. It's kind of a ruggedized VNA, which Rode's, they're ruggedized because they're built like tanks. But you know, the nano VNA, I would hate to drop it on a concrete ground because I don't know what would become of it under those circumstances.
I'm about to plug in the Rig Expert. I'll report that. Roy, and I wonder if, I guess after Wesley, I could ask Paul a question about CW.
Sure, I'm sure that Paul would like to answer your question. He's our big CW guy. I have a key in front of me. Unfortunately, I stopped using it a while ago, so my muscle memory has kind of faded. I got to relearn it, but I'm sure Paul would answer your question. Anyway, we're getting up to 8:25, and I mentioned that Andy is going to do an Andy's Corner tonight, and he wanted to do it around 8:30, so 8:25 is pretty close to 8:30. So, Andy, take it away with Andy's Corner.
Okay, Roy, thank you. Yeah, your signal again, it's, and hello to Bill. It's, I'm not sure why it's noisier than it has been, but I can't stay on that long tonight. I wasn't planning on going into work tomorrow, but I have to now because of a circumstance which I won't get into. But so I'm not going to stay on long. But I'm going to just touch on a subject, and then we can go into it deeper, on a deeper level, if anybody's interested in doing so. By the way, I have a little hub on this mic. I gotta find out why when I touch it, it hums. Anyway, so this is going to be an interesting topic because most hams, I would think would have this particular item in their shack performing a certain application, but they probably don't know why it performs and how it performs the way it does. Now, this is where Roy comes in, because there's a little bit of chemistry involved with this. So, so without keeping people in the dark, this is an RFI, which is a which is radio interference tip, TIP sheet. And it's the article is about using ferrite beads to keep RF out of TV sets, telephones, VCRs, burglar alarms, and other electronic equipment. And I think it's a very good topic because we are all, you know, inundated with interference from one thing or another. And there are ways to solve these interfering problems, or the interference sources, in this case, to alleviate these issues. So, this is an article by Palomar Engineers, and basically I'm just going to read it to get an idea if people would want to go into it on a deeper level as far as, you know, how these devices work in the first place. So I've been doing some research on it myself, and it's a learning curve for me because I'm not a chemist, but it's interesting how they manufacture these materials and what they do and how they work. So without any further ado, I'm going to unkey, and then I'll just read. It's two pages front and back. So I'm limited for time anyway. So I will talk about this, and then if you want to continue.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
All right, I'm listening to myself, so I know when I time out. Sorry about that. I'm going to have to be careful with that. So you guys can continue a discussion about it if you want. I thought it would be pretty interesting to talk about. All right, so here we go with this. Here's what it says. And again, you know, I can get into a deeper discussion as far as the chemical makeup of these ferrites and powdered iron cores and how they work. And there's a lot of interesting articles on even how to measure these devices to see which one will be the appropriate one to use for the particular application. So there's a lot to it. Just to let you know, most people just, I would think they would just buy a piece of one of those snap-on ferrite things that you can put around a piece of wire going to your power supply, and voila, you know, your problem is solved. But maybe they don't know if it's really the right one to be used, even though it's working. So this article sort of like sorts that out and discusses that. All right, so here we go. All right, got the beep, so I won't time. RFI and TBI have been with us for a long time. Now we have microwave ovens, VCRs, and many other devices that do wrong things when they pick up RF. Shows how old, by the way, how old this article is, because they talk about VCRs. Nobody uses VCRs anymore. So, there are several ways to tackle the problem, but most of them involve opening the affected equipment and adding suppressor capacitors, filters, and other circuit modifications. Unfortunately, there was a serious disadvantage associated with this approach. Any modifications made to domestic entertainment equipment can and often are blamed for later problems that arise in it. Modifying your own equipment is not so bad, but taking a soldering iron to your neighbor's stereo is risky. I'm going to unkey. I wouldn't recommend I heard something. I wouldn't recommend tearing into your neighbor's equipment and trying to solve the problem. It may do more damage than not. So here's the thing. An alternative, I should say, approach is to use ferrite beads to reduce the amount of RF entering the equipment. Sorry for my misspelling here. If the equipment is in a metal box or even if it's in a plastic box, the RF is prevented from entering the box on the antenna lead, the power cable, the speaker leads, the photo pickup leads, and on any other wires entering this box. It is possible to solve this problem without any modification to the equipment. Ferrite beads just slip over the wires and stops RF from getting in. Of course, now I'm going to just ad-lib here. Obviously, people want to know, how does this work? This is where it gets a little bit technical, and this is the way we get into the chemistry of how ferrite beads are made, and I'm sure Roy has a lot of information on that, you know, being a chemist, which I'm not. So, it goes on to say, ferrite beads are made of the same materials as the toroid cores used in broadband transformers, but are used at much higher frequencies. For example, ferrite, now just to let you know, there are different mixes, and there's a whole chart of the mixing solutions that they've come up with. So they say here, for example, ferrite mix number 43 is used for two circuits in the frequency range of 0.01 to 1 meg. And 0.1 meg is 100 kc, so 0.01 would be 10 kc, you know, mathematically speaking. So you go from 10 kc to 1 meg. It is efficient and losses are low. But if it is used in the 40 to 200 meg range, it is lossy. Let me unkey. All right, so there's some information right there regarding to the mix that we're using here. Let me go back here. It is lossy. But if it is used in the 40 to 200 megacycle range, it is lossy. So when you slip a bead of mix 43 over a wire and there is RF in the 40 to 200 megacycle range going down the wire, it is just as though you put a resistor in the wire. But you did not have to cut the wire to insert a resistor. You just slip a bead over the wire. And I'm sure most hams out there are familiar with these snap-on ferrite cores that you buy. I got a bunch of them. And again, you know, there are different mixes that they use. There's different core materials that they use, which we can get into later on. And, you know, in the frequency range of that they work on and so on. So, let me just drop. All right. So if the resistance of one bead is not enough, you can add more beads or add longer beads to get more resistance. The beads, unlike a resistor, do not affect the wire at low frequencies, so the audio, DC, and other low frequency components go through the wire just as though the bead was not there. So they give a chart here. In this particular case, there were three bead materials in general use that they use. It's called mix 73, mix 43, and mix 64. And I actually printed out a chart which corresponds to the different mixes. And the chart, of course, I can't show it, but this chart deals with different type of materials because it's categorized as suppression materials, which will suppress a certain interfering frequency, or inductive materials or power materials. And the power would be your toroids that are used in your antennas for matching, or your unbalanced to unbalanced, or balanced to balanced, and your ballon, and so on. In this case, we're just talking about suppression materials. And the property of the material goes on, just to mention, they talk about flux density, coercive force, loss factor, temperature coefficient, material type, and so on. It turns out, just an additional information from the research that I did, that ferrite cores, at least in this particular case, are constructed of two different types of materials in a compound. And one is called nickel zinc, and the other one is called manganese zinc, you know, which are the certain chemical properties. Each one of those has a certain bulk resistance, which you can actually measure with an ohmmeter, if you have a digital ohmmeter, or even an analog ohmmeter. So if you wanted to sort out, if you had a bunch of cores and you don't know what type of material it is, that's a starting point. Let me let it drop. It turns out that the nickel zinc core will have a higher resistivity, or what they call bulk resistance, to it, and a manganese core, or I should say manganese zinc core, will have a lower resistance, which you can actually measure. So there's actually a YouTube video where a guy's doing that experiment, where he wants to see, you know, what kind of core is this, because he doesn't know what kind it is. And he takes his ohmmeter, and he just places the probes on the core itself, and it could be a toroid, it could be a bead, you know, a snap-on bead, anything like that, any material. And if you do measure the resistance, and it's usually around 15,000 ohms or more, then you know that's the lower resistance as opposed to the higher resistance where he showed that he doesn't measure any resistance at all. It's like an open circuit. So the higher resistance would correspond to the nickel zinc core as opposed to the manganese zinc core. Now maybe it's a little bit confusing the way I'm explaining it, but I know some people will understand it. All right, I just added that as an addition to this article.
K-G-2-R-1.
Okay, I think I heard David out there. Go ahead.
QSO, good evening, Andy. Very interesting discourse about RFI and toroid cores. You know, I wanted to make my radio SWR better. I wanted to send more signal to the antenna. So I bought some number 31 mixed toroid core and put the wire around it in a coil. And the toroid cores, it didn't work so well, you know. But I had much better luck, you know, adjusting the ground and buying military-grade jumper cables. Go ahead.
Okay, very good. Well, let me just say one thing, and then I want to get back to this article. I don't want to deviate that far away from, you know, what I'm reading. I didn't think that putting a ferrite core would change your SWR. That would be a function of your antenna or load, whatever you're transmitting into. This article is about stopping interference from getting into pieces of equipment. So, all right. So I added that extra piece that I just mentioned, and I guess Roy can elaborate on that later on as far as the chemical compounds and how they work. But I want to continue this, so I'm going to just unkey. So as I mentioned earlier, there are three bead materials that are used in general, MIG 73, MIG 43, and MIG 64. And they have a certain impedance, which is actually and could be measured if you have a way of measuring it using an impedance meter. So, and to get these little inductive or impedance meters, you can buy a cheap one. They're not expensive anymore. One that fits in the palm of your hand, and you can, you know, play around if you want to see what the impedances are. But it turns out, and just for information's sake, because I give you an example here, bead material of a MiG 73 has an impedance at 1 meg of 45 ohms. At 10 megs, it's 110 ohms. At 40 megs, it's 110. At 100 megs, it's 110. And at 1,000 megs, it's 120. So that's pretty low impedance. That's for these mixes. And, of course, it also mentions bead material of a mix of 43 as opposed to 73, and then there's one of 64. It turns out that at 40 megs, the impedances are the same. They're 110 ohms, and I'm assuming it's in ohms, because that would be the impedance, and at the various frequencies. So it says here from the table, we can see that beads of the three materials work about the same at 40 megs. The impedance is identical, whereas the impedance is 110 ohms. Below 40 megs, material or mix 73 is best. Above 40 megs, material 64 is best. So for overall performance, from 1 to 1,000 megs, material 43 is the best choice. So that gives you some information to go by. So if you go and you want to buy one of these, and if you look in this chart, and now you go to your favorite ham store that sells these beads, or electronics store, you can now specify which mix you want to get for the application you want to use it for. So it's very good information, in my opinion. All right, let me let it drop. Okay. So continuing here, it is important to remember that the frequencies mentioned are those of the interfering signals to be eliminated, not the operating frequencies of the equipment being protected. For example, to protect the telephone operating at voice frequencies of 0.002 megs, we use type 43 or 73 beads to keep 14 megacycle frequency, you know, which is 20 meters, RF out. So in other words, if you want to stop your 20 meter signal from getting into your phone, you use this particular frequency range, which is corresponds to the 43 or 73 mix. And they designate mixes as numbers, which I have to do more research on where they get these numbers from, because it's a combination, as I said, of a mixing compound. So when you buy beads, you must specify both the physical size, and that's the other thing which I didn't mention up until now, and they're designated as FB-3, FB-8, and FB-whatever, and they come in all different sizes and shapes and so on. And the material, which is MiG 73, MiG 43, and etc. So depending on the frequency of the RF interference, so that's what you have to specify, and now you have an idea, again, of what kind of bead to get to buy for the application. All right, so here, FB1, ferrite B-1, ferrite B-3, and ferrite B-7 have, and this is a physical size, 0.05 inch holes that will slip over a bare wire of a number 18 gauge. So if you want to, you know, make a little toroid winding on a ferrite bead, it'll just slip right over that on an 18 gauge. And 18 gauge is a pretty small wire, relatively small. So if you know the wire size, you know, you can visualize the size of an 18 gauge wire. The lower The higher the number, the smaller the wire as far as gauges are concerned. So it says here, now that'll slip over. So satellite bead number 8 has a 0.09 hole. That's 0.09 inch hole, and will slip over the insulation of a number 22 gauge wire. As consequently, ferrite bead dash 24 and 63 have a 2-inch hole. That's pretty large to go over large wire or cables. And of course, you can actually get a bead or a toroid that you can slip over a piece of coax cable. And you wind some turns on that, you know, which is what your toroid looks like. But we're talking about beads right now, and not toroids, because that's a separate subject. So, we'll be on key. In fact, we'll gonna touch on toroids next. Incidentally, folks, I can go into this in depth as far as the chemistry is concerned, and how they come up with these numbers, and I can actually explain how to do an experiment, if you'd like to do so, on a workbench, where you could figure out yourself on what impedance and what bead you have. Let's say you have a junk pile full of unknown, you know, ferrite beads or unknown toroids, and you have no idea what their permeability is and their specifications. And, you know, with some pretty simple mathematical formulas and some experimentation, you can actually sort them out and figure it out and then decide which one will be used for the application you want to use it for. So, and again, you know, there are some videos on that which are pretty good. All right, let me continue. All right, okay, so we're going to talk about cables. So far we have talked about slipping beads over individual wires. But in many cases we are going to find two wire speaker cables, two wire or three wire power cables, twin lead antenna cables, multi-wire control cables, and so on. Cable wires are close together and act just like a single wire as far as the RF pickup is concerned. By the way, just as a note, I've taken apart some Cat5 cables, and if you noticed on Cat5, you know, they keep the common mode rejection down, the interference down, by twisting certain wires together. They actually alternate. I don't have the color code here in front of me, but there is a certain code that when you put an RJ45 connector on the end of a Cat5 cable, and there's different classifications, obviously. What are they up to, Cat6 now or something? I don't remember. You'll see that the wires are twisted, and they're done. It's done purposely because they want to isolate crosstalk and interference amongst the cable itself. So there's a certain rule for that they use. Just to let you know. All right. Let me unkey. Okay, so let's see where I left off. Just a single wire. Okay. So the last thing I said was cable wires are close together and act just like a single wire as far as RF pickup is concerned. So the whole cable can go through the bead, and this will suppress RF transmission through all of the cable wires. This is a lot easier than putting beads on each wire. Makes sense? Okay, so the last thing it's talking about is twin lead. Now, in this day and age, if everybody knows what twin lead is, you know, is the flat cable that you used to use on your TV sets. Most of the twin lead, as far as I know, is 300 ohms. Going into your antenna, and we use twin lead in a way. We call it ladder line, going to our, because it's a balanced line, by the way, and that goes to our dipole antenna. So the best feed line to be used on a dipole would be a balanced line, so you don't have to have a balance for matching. of course, the impedance of the line is not going to match the antenna's impedance, depending on what kind of antenna you're using, but you're still using a balanced line. And a lot of hams use balanced lines, which are known as ladder lines or something of that nature. And the spacing between the lines affects the impedance, as we know. All right, I just added that in. Let me just continue. Okay, so it says here, twin leaders is a special case. If you put a bead on each wire, you'll kill the TV signal. But the whole twin lead, but if the whole twin lead goes through a single bead, this TV signal goes on through, but the RF interference is suppressed by the bead. So this is because the twin lead is a transmission line to the TV signal that looks like a single wire to the RF interference. So that's an interesting point. So this brings us to coax cable. Signal going through the coax is confined to the inside of the coax shield, but the outside of the shield acts just like any wire. It can pick up RF, and that RF can be carried to the TV or monitor. Shield beads placed over the cable will suppress the interference. Okay, so the next paragraph, we're going to just talk about toroids, because we've been talking about beads. So I'm just going to hit upon that. And again, if this sparks anyone's interest and they want to learn more about it, I will continue this subject next time, but go into a further depth as I study it to explain the different mixes and the materials and the permeabilities and how it's used and even the experiments that you could make on your own to figure this out for your own application. I find it fascinating because, you know, we live in an electronic age, everything around us, and there's a lot of interference out there, as most of us know, and there's a lot of head scratching on how do you get rid of interference. And I think most of you guys will agree, we're using these materials to do that, but you got to make sure you're using the right material, and that's what this article is about. Okay, I'm not taking any questions now because I am on limited time here. It's 9 o'clock already, and I just want to go through just a few more paragraphs, and then we'll stop. And again, it's food for thought, you know, to be continued if you guys want to continue the subject. You know, we'll see what happens with that. All right, so going into toroids, so now it says, when you start talking about slipping beads over coax cable and multi-wire cables, we'll see that we may need beads with pretty big holes. Of course, a toroid will have a larger hole than a bead. Also, if the cable has a molded plug on the end, like some power cords, for example, the plug has to go through the hole, and we may need a very big hole indeed to go through the hole. Obviously, to go through the hole. You don't want to cut the plug off if you can help it. Fortunately, a variety of ferrite toroid cores are available with holes as big as 1.4-inch diameter. So it's 1.25-inch diameter approximately hole, which is pretty large. They are not available in all the same materials as beads, but in similar ones. As a guide, when specifying toroids for RF suppression, as you want to write this down, a mix 77 is the best below 40 megs. A mix 43 can be used from 1 to 1,000 megs and is the best from 30 to 150 megs. So that's the range they specify. And a mix 61 is the best above 200 megs. So, again, it's just a guide. But you know, at least you have an idea of the different mixes. Let me unkey. So, let's see here. And we're talking about basically toroids now because of the larger opening. So after you put that big plug through the toroid hole, you'll find that the toroid fits the cable very loosely. And it says, don't worry, it'll still work fine if there is room to do it. As long as you have room to put that cable in there, the toroid will do its job, okay? Loop the cable around and run it through the toroid again if you can, depending on the size of the cable. Do this as many times as you can. So there's no limit to how many times you want to do this. Each turn is just like adding another toroid. And using the Big Mix 61 cores, you add an inductive choke where the two turns is four times as good as one turn. And that's because of the inductance is a mathematical function. It's the turn squared, and that's why they mentioned that. So you can put as many turns as you want. You just add more inductance. And of course, the more inductance, the more suppression you should have in this particular case. So there's an inductive choke at two, four, okay, three. So three turns is nine times as good. You know, so it's a multiplication factor if you know your how your inductances work. So they mentioned that. Okay. We're coming to the end, but a few more little things to mention. Okay, there's also another type of bead called a split bead. So it looks like they jumped from these round beads to toroids, and now we're back to split beads again. A split bead, it looks like a square with a hole in it, but you can open it up. So it says here, now this is old by now, but this article, I'm not sure when it was written. It says there was a new development to solve the problem of putting beads or toroids over cables that leave big plugs in the end. They are beads that have been cut in half. Put the two halves over the cable and then wrap them with tape to hold them together. All right, so, you know, the split beads that I was mentioning, they do package them in a plastic housing that you can open up, and they snap together, the snap-on ones. This is mentioning the ones that don't snap on. They just split. You just place the cable inside, and you put tape around it and hold it together, if you could visualize that. So this article is a little bit on the older side, but they're showing this anyway.
If you have a question.
Who's that station?
KG2RY. Andy, I have a question for you. Do you know about the monster toroid?
No. Hold off on that, David, because I just want to finish this up, okay?
Sure thing.
Okay, I'm sure, you know, in this day and age, there's a lot of different toroids out there and beads and everything, and, that have come into existence. All right. So we're talking about split beads. So as I said, these are beads that have been cut in half. You put the two halves over the cable and wrap them with tape to hold them together. The mating edges are polished smooth so that the halves mate very smoothly. And they're also available with center holes from a quarter inch and a half inch diameter. Oh, okay, full quarter and a half inch diameter. Also, the flat computer cable is, I don't know why it says that, also four flat computer cables, so for those cables. You can have a 2-inch or 2.5-inch wide hole, it says here. So it is important that the two halves of the split beads fit exactly together. Because that would affect the inductance overall, and the magnetic flux and the lines of force and everything else that goes on in a piece of a ferrite core. So you want to make sure that they fit nicely. I guess the snap-on ones are designed so they fit just like that, and you don't have to fuss with it. You just, you know, open it up and place it over and snap it closed. So it goes on to say the quarter-inch hole beads cannot be used for cables larger than a quarter inch. It does not matter if the cable is smaller than the hole. So obviously the hole size will limit the size of the cable, which makes sense. All right, let me keep. Okay, so all split beads...